And welcome to today's teleconference. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. You may register to ask a question at any time during today's call by pressing star and one on your touch-tone phone. We'll take questions in turn following the presentation. Please note today's call may be recorded. It's now my pleasure to turn the program over to Peter Angood. Please begin, sir.
Thank you very much, and good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for finding the time to join us in follow-up to our face-to-face meeting from recently. The call today is part of our ongoing groups. Sorry, I've got my animals going crazy on me. The difficulties with working at home on the holiday week is always a problem, so my apologies. The purpose of today's call is primarily to just continue the momentum that we engendered out of that face-to-face meeting, to review some of the activity from that meeting, and then to continue us on our discussion of what is it that NQF needs to be doing further with its existing patient safety programs, and what other types of activity is it that NQF should consider in terms of trying to optimize its platform as it relates to patient safety in American healthcare. Before we get started, I just wanted to run the roster list to see who's joined. So as your name comes up, if you could please just acknowledge whether you're on, that would be great. And then we'll get a quick review of the minutes, and then we'll jump into the other activities of the agenda. Jim Bajian, are you on?
Yes, I am.
Thanks, Jim. Jane Barnsteiner? Bob Bunting, I heard you earlier.
Yes, I'm still here, thanks.
Yeah, Dave Klassen, I heard.
Yes, I'm here, thanks.
Mike Cohen, have you joined?
I'm here, yes.
Hey, great, Mike, thank you. Chuck Denham, are you on? Dan Ford, I heard you.
Yes.
Bruce Hall is not able to make it. Helen Haskell, I heard you come on.
Yes, I'm here.
Great. Dick Hawkins, are you able? John Hittner, are you there? David Knowlton? Nancy LeVay?
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah. Bill Meisel? Dave Mayer can't make it. Philip Mailer cannot make it. Denise, I heard you.
Yes, Denise Murphy, I'm here.
Great, thanks. Rita Shane? Arjun Sharma, you came on a few moments ago, I believe.
Yes, I'm here, Peter.
Great. Sam Watson?
I'm here. Thanks, Peter.
Great. And Bob Weirs, are you able to make it? Well, that's a good listing. Thank you, everybody, for joining us in today. That is very good turnout, actually. And before we get further on, I just wanted to see if anyone had comments on the minutes from the meeting that we had last month. And if there were, now would be a good time to bring up any comments or clarifications or any omissions that we had in that set of minutes.
No comments. This is Sam.
Oh, great. Well, if you think of some after the fact, please don't hesitate to email them to us, and we'll assume for the time that the minutes are fine by everybody. Excuse me. I hope at the face-to-face meeting that we were able to provide you with a good broad-based background as to what NQF and the NQF safety programs were all about. I know for some of you it left you feeling a little bit loose at the end because there were some specific questions that we had asked you to answer. And that was by design, because we wanted to make sure that we got the group started off with that broad-based funneling approach. But as we move into these next several months of phone calls and then another face-to-face meeting later, as we update you with our activities, we want to make sure that we get good, solid, focused input from you and that we get new ideas from you. We don't necessarily just want reactions to questions we pose, but hopefully as you gain more deep understanding of what NQF's all about and where we're headed right now, that we'll get some further suggestions from each of you in terms of where we could and should be going. Before we get too much further into the agenda, though, I wanted to open it up with just preliminary reactions from folks to that first meeting and some comments from anyone in terms of what else we could or should have done with that first meeting and what your hopes are that we will have moving forward. Does anybody want to jump in on that one?
This is Rita Shane. I mean, I think that the meeting was excellent in kind of giving us an understanding of the NQF and priorities. I guess some specific action items for the coming 12 months, if, I mean, I understand this is evolving, but in terms of action items and specifics in terms of what we as members can, you know, become actively engaged in.
Right. Well, excuse me, the specific purpose of the group is to provide us with this advisory role on the activities that we're undertaking and to provide us with the inputs in terms of whether we're heading in the right direction, the wrong direction, and what is it that we can do further. The questions that we circulated a little bit earlier today are to help try and get a bit more focus on that specific part of it. As we evolve with the different components of the safety activities, then we'll also have opportunity for each of you on this committee to be engaged with some of the initiatives that are ongoing. I know already a few of you are on some of our activities like the Safe Practices or the ARC Common Formats Steering Committee. And so as we continue discussions, if any of you have a desire for some further involvement, we can certainly look for ways to do that. As we get through a little further in the agenda, you'll see where some of the activity is actually headed. So does that help you a little bit, Rita?
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I think, you know, when I went through the information from last meeting, what was clear is, at least what I took away, were recommendations of evidence-based best practices and prioritizing where harm occurs. So
right.
My sense is if we can meet those, if we continue those themes as we move forward with the questions that were asked and other opportunities for engagement, I think we'll all feel like that we're headed in the right direction.
That's helpful. Thank you. Other comments?
Peter, this is Denise. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we're good, Denise.
Okay. So one of the things I think about a lot in terms of being on a more strategic group that's advising rather than a technical advisory committee that's really getting into the vetting of best practices or measurements and so on, I guess I do feel a little bit lost and would like to know if there's, for example, if there's something coming up that we'll be we'll be working on and we'll be specifically, you know, advising one of the other councils on, something where there's a deadline. Can you just speak to that for a minute? And I haven't been in the office today, so I apologize for not having the list of questions in front of me. So I apologize if I'm the only one that's kind of out there on this.
No,
sort of
no
what's
problem.
Our next mission.
Yeah, and your comments fully appropriate, Denise. Thank you. As we go through a quick update on the patient safety projects that are going on, then what we will be doing is actually asking this group for some specific comments on those individual projects and if it's headed in the right direction or not, in your opinion. And it is easier to run a committee that's highly focused with specific issues that are being addressed and opinions are being focused. And NQF's steering committees historically have been very much that way focused. This is a bit more of a broad-based strategy, and it feels a little bit more nebulous. It's certainly a bit more nebulous to manage it from my side, I'll tell you. But we do want those specific inputs on the different projects as we present the updates to you on them. And you'll feel some of that in the next couple of minutes, actually.
Peter, this is Nancy Lavella. I think from the last meeting, too, I think we also talked about looking at how things transcend across the continuum of care, too, where it may not just be a problem that's in one setting, that, but maybe continuing on, and keep our minds open to those issues as well.
Yeah, that's, I think, a good point, and Nancy, just keep reminding us of that for sure. Related to that and is one of the other groups that we have working on safety with the National Priorities Partnership. That work group has begun its work focusing in on the perioperative environment and the issues related to prevention of surgical site infections and other HAIs, the prevention of serious reportable events, not just the wrong site surgery, but pressure ulcers, et cetera, and then the whole issue of cross-disciplinary team training and improved team function. And in that discussion, there was some highlighting, not only in terms of looking at the continuum of care, but to make sure that we don't just prematurely jump to so-called solutions for what we are perceived as problems, but to spend some time in making sure that the risk identification or the hazard identification piece is focused upon as well. And so I mention all of that because I think as a barometer, if you will, in addition to what you just mentioned, Nancy, I think making sure that we're not too quickly moving into what we think are solutions and making sure that we're adding value to some of these initiatives like what was suggested for hazard or risk identification are important areas for this group as well.
Great.
Other comments? Okay. Well, those are all very helpful comments. I appreciate that. And what I thought I would do is very briefly give you an update on where we're at with some of the other groups' activities. We have two specific ones that we're going to provide some updates for you on the agenda. And then after we get through those two, wanted to spend some time focusing in on those questions that we posed through the email. And for those of you who were unable to pull your email yet today, we'll repeat those questions as we get started. The I just mentioned the NPP project, and that work group is moving along at a reasonable pace. We have another work group phone call set up for them in the next little while. Any of you have specific interests in the perioperative environment and want some more details, we'll certainly be able to help provide them. But as I said, those three focuses of HAI and the serious reportable events and the team cross-disciplinary team training were the primary focuses for perioperative environment. And that won't be the only area that this group focuses upon. Once we get through the perioperative area, the group will choose another environment in which to stay focused, whether it's in the hospital setting or outside of it. The group will decide that over time. The update to the safe practices for 2010 were recently reviewed and approved by our Consensus Standards Approval Committee, our so-called CSAC, and the update of those safe practices is really just a lightweight buffing of the existing safe practices that were released in March. They will be ratified by the board at the within the next week or two, and then we will be moving into a more detailed, in-depth review of the safe practices during 2010 for the 2011 update. Early in January or thereabouts, there'll be calls for new safe practices as well as for comments on the existing safe practices, and we are going to be freshening up the Safe Practices Steering Committee. So if any of you have some interest in that steering committee, keep an eye out for that set of calls that will happen in January. The discussion at the CSAC around the safe practices was fairly robust, actually. In general, everyone thought the safe practices were headed in the right direction. They have a unique focus in the healthcare areas. There is recognition they do not mesh well with the serious reportable events or perhaps even with the patient safety measures that we have at NQF. And there is general agreement that we need to continue to push that closer together, but without losing the unique capacities or components of the safe practices. One particular area that is creating some ongoing discussion, and it's to the point that we need to form a focused task force, a short-term task force, and that's around the issue of evidence-based hospital referrals. There was a safe practice in the 2006 edition that had a specific focus on the issue of referring patients to hospitals that have higher volumes and presumably have better outcomes as a result of higher outcomes for some high-volume elective surgical procedures. That was collapsed down into a bullet of the informed consent safe practice, and the LeapFrog group plus several others have expressed strong concern that while the informing the patients about this volume outcome relationship is important, the evidence base behind this is not complete nor necessarily stable at this point in time, and so everyone is uncomfortable further expanding that bullet point in the safe practice on informed consent. So we will be forming up a task force to look at this whole issue on a broader plane to review what the evidence base is currently, where the evidence base is headed, and to see how NQF can best address this issue of evidence-based hospital referrals, either within the safe practices or within other strategies, or perhaps we shouldn't be dealing with it at all at this point in time. So that's the NPP update, the safe practices update, and the other activity that we have to do some work on is doing an ad hoc review on the SCIP measure related to surgical site infections, and specifically that around the methodology of hair removal. There's been some strong concern expressed by a variety of professional organizations that the language of the SCIP measure stating that the use of razors should be prohibited is inaccurate. There's no evidence to support that, and so there's been a request both of CMS as well as NQF and the Joint Commission to review the language in their respective programs and to review whether or not that language should be modified to accommodate the use of razors. At this point in time, that language basically says that razors should not be used. So we'll be forming a very quick turnover task force to address that, to look at the evidence a little bit further and to make some recommendations. And that will potentially impact both the surgical site infection measures, the SCIP measures, as well as the safe practice, because we have some language under SSI that basically reflects the same language as the Joint Commission's patient safety goals, and it, you know, as I said earlier, says razors should not be used.
Peter, this is Denise Murphy. Is it okay to ask a question during the update, or would you prefer if we waited?
No, by all means. I would rather you guys be interactive than me just droning. So by all means.
Okay. So at last week's HICPAC meeting, this is the Infection Control Practice Advisory Committee, for those of you who aren't familiar with HICPAC, we were looking at our list of guidelines in the queue, and I know the surgical site guideline is very old, and it's not on the table today. but would there be any effort, Peter, since HITPAC has a, let's see, I guess a venue or a center that they work with to really vet the evidence around particular issues and practices that will become part of a national guideline. In this case, you know, we realize that the next surgical site infection prevention guideline is really ready to be updated. Would this be something that we would consider a partnership with HICPAC, even though they're not writing the full guideline, but since they have a body that is charged with getting into and scoring the evidence to maybe do this in a partnership? Or what are your thoughts about that? Or is it that NQF has their own engine for doing that and it would be preferable not to mix it? I'd just like to know what your thoughts are.
Yeah, great question, Denise. And no, we don't have our own engine about scoring and grading the evidence. We tend to use the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force methodology when we do have a need to score and grade some evidence, but we don't routinely do that for all of the measures or the safe practices. In general, we're looking for ways to work together and to harmonize with other groups so that we can have a similarity of approaches. And so we would be very open to working with the HICPAC group on this particular one, as well as other infection control strategies as well.
And
Peter,
this
great,
is
Mike.
Sorry, just say, Denise, that's one of the questions. Who should we work together to harmonize with? So that's a good leading question. Sorry, I just cut somebody off.
That's okay. Are you finished, though, with that?
Yep.
I didn't mean to cut anybody off. I'm sorry.
No
this is Mike. I did have a quick question about the safe practices. You know, I've been involved with that now, I guess, since its inception, the committee, that is.
Yes.
I'm wondering, we don't get a lot of feedback as far as you know, the uptake on that is outside of the Joint Commission, and, you know, obviously you've been harmonizing with other organizations a bit, but to what extent is that getting picked up by the Medicare folks in, as far as COPs and then also the hospital level? And do you do any advocacy to push those? I mean, at the state level, state health department level, do you do any advocacy to push those?
Right. Well, I think the short answer, Mike, is we don't do enough. And part of what we are trying to find the resources to do is a full kind of environmental assessment, if you will, of not just the safe practices and their uptake and their utilization and their success or failure, but we want to do that with some of the other NQF programs as well. And so we're in the early spring, the plan is to hopefully launch that type of an environmental assessment into place so that we can get a better sense of how our programs and our products are being utilized. It's been a number of years that these, specifically the safe practices, have been in place, and we can't give you the solid answer.
Yeah. I mean, you've had input from a lot of really good people on the committees, and I do think there's a greater role perhaps for advocacy from NQF,
right?
Not just safe practices, but as you say, other things that you're working on as well, and maybe even, you know, beyond that.
Right. Good point. Thanks, Mike.
Peter, can I make a comment? Chuck?
No, Chuck, you're on now. Thank you,
yeah.
By all means.
Yeah, I've been on mute. There is increasing, I think it's really gratifying to see that even despite the, you know, the opportunity for advocacy, Mike, there is more and more uptake of them. It just takes time. It's, I guess, with our 17-year adoption rate for innovation, we're on track, but maybe ahead of track. But there appears to be, continued to be more and more uptake on them, and as they're updating the COPs, they are you can see the fingerprints of the practices and some of the other NQF work. It just takes time, though.
Thanks, Chuck. All right. Those were actually my main updates. There was one last item I wanted to make comment on, and that is the WHO had an update conference call last week with their Reporting for Learning initiative, and that's important because that will impact this framework report that Melinda Murphy is going to talk about in just a moment. But the WHO panel is getting formalized further into the WHO processes with ongoing input from the WHO Alliance offices and looking at ways in which the reporting of sentinel events, the review of root cause analyses are high on that group's activities. There is talk about how to possibly harmonize the efforts or unify the efforts into a similar strategy around the countries that are engaged with this. And there continues to be a lot of interest in what we're doing in the States as it relates to reporting and specifically patient safety reporting overall. So we'll keep you guys plugged in with that. There has not been an update document recently distributed, but as soon as one comes up, we'll make sure this committee gets covered with it. So with that, Melinda, can you provide a short update to the group on the framework steering committee?
Yes, and I'm not certain what information they've had coming into this call, but this work is part of the work under the contract that NQF has with Health and Human Services. And the group that is working with this will be developing a patient safety public reporting framework that will address the challenges and opportunities that are related to public reporting of patient safety information with a focus to some extent on the serious reportable events, healthcare acquired conditions. So the framework will provide guidance for how to approach the development and refinement of a public report that will take into account, as I said, the challenges and opportunities related to measurement and evaluation of patient safety performance. The steering committee is a committee of 16 people chaired by Ann Monroe with Community Health Foundation of Western and Central New York, and Elliot Lazar, New York Presbyterian Healthcare System. So that group met for its first time on the 20th of November, has regular monthly meetings scheduled toward an in-person meeting in January, at which time it's expected that they will sit down and hammer out, actually refine what they will have already begun, an outline for this framework for public reporting of patient safety information, headed toward a public comment period opening mid-March. They will deal with things such as what is unique about patient safety events. Are there things about types of events, for example, the frequently occurring events versus the rarely occurring events that should be taken into consideration in conveying what that means in a public reporting context? So I'll stop there, Peter. If there are particular things you would like to know in more detail about it, I'd be happy to try to answer questions.
Anyone have comments or questions to Melinda?
Melinda, it's David Klassen.
Hi, David.
How you doing? Is this work going to supersede the work CMS has already done on the HACs? How it will be related to the work that's already been done?
This is really focusing on how to and what the group will do is to take into consideration the work that is ongoing now, work that is in place. For example, as you know, there is information in the common formats that the group will be able to use. There's information from RAND that the group will be able to use. The WHO work related to the International Classification for Patient Safety and the reporting and learning as well as the NQF work. There's an NQF guideline for consumer-focused public reporting that was published in early 08, and there was a report published in 2008 on consensus standards for reporting healthcare-associated infection data that has a clear section about public reporting. So a long-winded answer to say what the group is going to try to do is to take into consideration those things that are in existence or that are ongoing that will help inform putting together a framework to be used by entities that are publishing reports or expecting to do so.
Does that help, Dave?
Yes, yes.
I just want to make sure that we continue to try and clarify this term of HAC. In the work that we're doing for HHS, we have three primary deliverables. One is to expand the concept of serious reportable events into other environments of care, and that term that the HHS folks like to use is healthcare acquired conditions, not hospital, but healthcare acquired conditions. The second deliverable is to expand the patient safety measures into these other environments of care as well. And the third is this framework report that Melinda just mentioned. The healthcare acquired conditions term has actually not been, as near as we can tell, well-defined or even loosely defined by HHS at this point. And we wind up spending a lot of time talking about whether it's healthcare-associated, as in healthcare-associated infections, or whether it's healthcare-acquired, as in hospital-acquired conditions. And this is turning out to be a bit more of a sticking point than we had anticipated. We met with the state-based reporting agencies a couple of weeks back. We had 22 out of the 28 known state-based reporting entities, and it's clear that the use of the serious reportable events is the basis for the majority of the reporting. But it's also clear that there's quite a bit of variety in the terms, the strategies, and the methods that these individual reporting entities use. So we took them through a variety of exercises to try and get a better sense of what some of the strengths and weaknesses are, what are some of the methods that they think need to be done to instill a quality improvement strategy, if you will, into this, and then took them through sort of how is it that we can learn from this reporting as opposed to just reporting. And we're just in the latter stages of finalizing the synopsis from that meeting, and we'll distribute that to this group as soon as we get it done. But the variety was certainly there. That's important because it will impact the work that Melinda was just describing. The other entity, the National Academy of State Health Policy, or NASHP as they like to be called, recently convened a meeting to focus in on how to improve the communication between the state and federal levels, and utilized the non-payment of the hospital-acquired conditions as their focus for discussion. And again, it came through loud and clear that the serious reportable events are the mainstay around which a lot of this focuses. There's a lot of infrastructure in place in numerous levels, at the federal level, at the state level, within healthcare systems, healthcare organizations. And yet, the state-level reporting winds up being sort of lost in the middle of all of this, and we don't have uniformity of an approach. And so, again, this steering committee that Melinda just mentioned will hopefully put the frameworks up as well as the recommendations up for how to improve the reporting strategies overall. Now, that has the potential to also overlap or even impact some of that work, David, that you've been working with, and that's the common formats and the whole patient safety organization initiative.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, it comes back to these questions of how do we get NQF to harmonize and work stronger with some of these other initiatives.
Sure.
All righty. Any other questions on that one? All right, hearing none, it's turning into be more of a reporting meeting than a dialogue, but that might be just the way the early stages of our committee. I will give a short synopsis of our SRE steering committee, which met last Wednesday and Thursday, and then we can look briefly or just highlight up the couple of the different materials that we provided to you late last week, and then we'll close off with a discussion of some of those questions that we sent out earlier today. The state-based, the meeting around the maintenance of the serious reportable events occurred last week, and we spent a fair amount of time reviewing the definition of a serious reportable event and the components of the language in there. And we wound up actually with that group thinking that we may not need this term healthcare acquired conditions. But I'll come back to that in a few minutes. The reason we wind up thinking that is because this is where we could use some of your opinion. So listen closely if you could. And Eric, we sent the PowerPoint slides to these folks?
That's correct, yes,
okay,
in the first supplemental email.
Eric, I didn't get those.
The PowerPoints, Peter, though, not from today, from the recent SRE meeting, but from the October 6th meeting, we had sent them. So,
But I can
get up the ones from today if you'd
could
like.
Could you bring up those five slides from
sure.
earlier, please, so the group can see them? And I'll also discuss it for those who are on cell phones and traveling. But basically, while Eric is doing that, the core term, serious reportable events, was changed from defined as preventable, serious, and unambiguous adverse events that should never occur. It was changed to defined as preventable, serious, and unambiguous adverse events that should not occur. And we spent an awful lot of time around never versus not. And a lot of that discussion focused in on whether never was an unrealistic expectation and whether it had legal ramifications that were putting practitioners and institutions at risk in a variety of ways that originally were not intended. So there was a lot of pro and con discussion in terms of that word change. In the end, however, the group agreed that this change to events that should not occur is important in terms of trying to not have organizations at risk, but it still sends the message that these are the types of things that just should not occur in healthcare. And that it didn't lose the sense of urgency about the importance of looking after these conditions. I haven't looked closely. Have you got those slides up yet, Eric? No. So early reactions to this word change in the definition of a serious reportable event. Defined as preventable, serious, and unambiguous adverse events that should not occur.
John Hickner here. I think it's a good idea. I think it's going to make it more palatable for folks.
Thanks, John.
I mean, as you probably know, I never liked the never events thing. I think this is taking it down the road that makes a little more sense and is more rational, so I think it's a good change.
Thanks, Jim.
Bob Weirs. I would agree with that.
Oh, great. Bob, thank you for joining us.
This is Sam. I agree. I think it makes it much clearer also for people to understand what we really mean by it. Nervance is just way too strong.
Right. And that was what a majority of the members in the committee last week felt as well. NQF, just for the record, has, while Ken Kaiser may have coined the term way back when, we have not been promulgating the term never events. In fact, are actively dissuading its use. So that was part of the reason for this word change.
Well, Peter, this is Bob Bunty. I'm glad to hear you say that you're dissuading the use, because when we wrote the book that I mentioned before, we struggled with that because we didn't like the term never events, but everybody else was calling it that, so we felt obligated to use it. And even now today at our company, when we have companies come to us wanting to purchase insurance, the first thing that they ask is what is our approach to never events? And what is so sad is they don't even know how to define them, but they want to know what our approach is. So there's a lot of ambiguity and misunderstanding about those terms.
Great. Thank you. Does anybody?
Peter, this is Arjun. I'd certainly support that, too, because there are enough rare scenarios that never is too hard a word to use.
Right. Yeah. That was, again, the feeling of the group that, you know, you don't want them to have happen, but they're going to happen. And they shouldn't happen, but they happen.
It's also a recognition that Shakespearean tragedy is not dead, a recognition that no matter how hard you try, the tragedy is a part of the human existence that's not going to go away.
Exactly.
So I'm glad to know that Shakespeare is not dead.
Yeah. With folks like you bringing and reminding us, that's great. Thanks.
This is Dan Ford. I think that's constructive and more realistic.
Okay. This input's actually very helpful for us. I appreciate that. While we've heard everybody support this term change, I want to make sure that, is there anybody on the line who would actually prefer that we keep the word never in that definition?
This is Helen. Never doesn't really have a lot of significance for me as a consumer. I guess my one, what seems to me might be sort of promising about the use of the word not is that it could portend an expansion of the list into things that are not so grave. Is that a possibility?
Very much, Helen, and thanks for bringing that up. That's partly why it's partly why this group headed in that direction by changing this term, and I'll go over a couple of other terms that got changed as well. It actually allows the expansion of the list and into other environments beyond just hospital settings much more easily. And it gets back to the term about reportability as well.
Peter, along that same line, I think one of the things that we as the insurance industry face is purchasers, especially large national accounts, come to us and ask for reports on their preventable adverse events, and they want to know how much money they have saved. And historically, that's, as you can imagine, extremely difficult to do. And we've tried to explain to them that the focus on these issues is not necessarily to save money, it's to increase awareness and improve quality. Yet the purchasers always want to tie it back to a dollar amount, and especially if you're following the CMS guidelines about the DRG grouper and the reimbursement reductions related to that, not every event is going to result in a reimbursement reduction. So I don't know that this water could get any muddier.
Good comments as well, Bob. And it is where the committee last week headed as well. What's the purpose, really? The purpose is to improve quality and safety in healthcare. Finances are separate. Other comments on this? Eric, if you could put up the next slide, please, on the SRE definition for the group. So we changed that basic definition, and then, again, for those who are on cell phones, there were three kind of provisos that go with this, and that is the current set of SREs is not intended to capture all events, but the events are of concern to both the public and healthcare professionals and providers, to clearly identifiable and measurable and thus feasible to include in a reporting system, and then three, of a nature such that the risk of occurrence is significantly influenced by the policies and procedures of the healthcare facility. So the group did not change those three bullets and felt that the purpose and the intent of the SRE still followed these three parameters.
This is Rita. I know the definition's already there, but I would just wonder if the word systems should be added to policies and procedures.
Good suggestion. I'll bring that to the group. Thank you, Rita. Other comments? All right. The next slide has some criteria.
Can I ask one thing on this?
Yeah, by all means.
I guess one of the questions, when it says, in bullet two, it says clearly identifiable and measurable. I guess one of the things that's always a problem with any of the reporting systems is all they are is measures of what's reported. They aren't measures of what's really going on.
Right.
And I always worry. I mean, people that understand that, it's fine. But, between the press, legislatures, others, sometimes people will dwell on a given number as if it's reality and miss the point that these reports, for the most part, the best you can think about, in my opinion, is that they identify where there's vulnerabilities in the system that deserve further scrutiny or potentially action. But you would hate to compare one to another and say, oh, this is a bigger problem than the other one just because of the number of reports, because that's clearly not the case.
Right. That's a good point, and that's why we've got Melinda on this call to pick up those kinds of points so that we make sure we get them into the framework group as well.
I have so many of these, and only one of them doesn't work. So I'm hoping I have my
changes.
Yeah,
right.
You'll take that back.
Is someone trying to talk with us, or is that background noise?
This is Rita. Just to add to that point, maybe we can put this aside as something when we talk about next steps. I know it was brought up at our last meeting, but I think the comments that were just made about how these metrics get become a belief system when they're not based on reality. They just help us to understand what's going on in organizations, and maybe NQF can play a role in kind of debunking this myth that you should be looking at numbers. We even had, I know we talked about denominators and numerators, but every event is something that represents something that we don't want to happen, and therefore we should look at these harmful events and try to determine how to prevent them instead of chasing numbers, because I see that happening, and especially for non-clinicians, the belief is if you chase the numbers, you're doing a good job in the safety realm, and that's not necessarily true.
Right.
It's what you do with the information.
Yeah, Jim Bajan. I mean, I absolutely agree with that, and I think that's maybe with there's some good examples of that might help. I can get with you offline if you want, Peter, but, we have ones where we had very few reports out of literally, I was just talking to the HHSIGs today. They were over to visit us, and we showed them examples where we only had a few reports out of like 750,000 reports, a few about, for instance, the use of benzocaine as a topical anesthetic. And yet when we went out and looked, just because our common sense that I bet this happens a lot, it was happening everywhere but not reported almost anywhere, including inside or outside the VA. And it was through the prospective kind of study, I'll say in quotes, that we verified this is a huge issue that people had just become inured to and, resulted in us, banning this from the VA and many others have since. But, the point is that had we just tried to crunch numbers, nobody ever would have looked at this. And I think we have to really be careful about what people kind of over-extrapolate or over-generalize from what they think these numbers mean. Plus, there's also ample evidence of when people start changing numbers, you get a lot of intentional and unintentional gaming.
Yep, right? Absolutely. So anyway, maybe we could discuss that as a separate issue, because I think NQF could do a lot in terms of trying to point organizations in the direction of looking for things that are harmful rather than looking at numbers that have no meaning.
Yeah, I think that I just cut somebody off, but that gets to some of the opening comments I was
right.
making about NPP, about risk identification, et cetera, as opposed to just layering on a solution or a proposed assumed solution. Sorry, who did I just cut off?
It was Mike, but I think you pretty much covered what I was going to say. I just, just to add, I guess, the number of reports are only as good as the folks that are willing to report them at the, you know, at the patient interface.
Right.
Obviously, that doesn't always happen, unfortunately. But these numbers are not big, the serious reportable events. In the states where I've seen them, you're just talking about very few numbers of events.
Yeah, and that's part of the other discussion, is, and this group at our face-to-face brought it up as well, and that's moving to where, moving away from the rare, uncommon things to where the harm's really occurring more frequently on less severe items.
Yeah.
Peter, Dan Ford,
yeah.
Did you consider the human behavior piece for number bullet three?
It actually didn't come up, Dan, and I was surprised by that. We can certainly bring that up for the group again.
Well, this is Sam, and I would second that, because what we've found in our work is culture is a significant part of this. And it's more than just the policies and procedures.
Yeah.
It's the adaptive work, the behavior change that needs to be considered when events occur.
This is Jim Bajan. I would second that.
Okay. We'll certainly bring that back to the to that group. Good comments. Thank you. there's a couple more quick slides here. The criteria of SREs is the next slide. Hopefully Eric will get that up. And
it's up.
It, for whatever reasons we couldn't quite understand, there was the term and or in between each of these. So an event must then be unambiguous, preventable, serious, and any of the following: adverse, indicative of a problem in a healthcare facility's safety systems, important for public credibility or public accountability. We had and or between those bullets. We just struck those out. It could be any one of those three. Any comments on that?
Just a little clarification with the grammar. I would suppose it should say have an adverse outcome. I don't know what adverse alone means.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's and we had some grammar folks in the room, I'll tell you that. But we can bring that back to them. Thank you.
Peter, this is Jim Bajan. I guess there's one thing I know. The word's been used several times before, and it's to me there's always issues with it, and that is the whole preventable.
Right.
Because depending on how you look at it, depending on the sophistication and outlook of the people making the evaluation, they can, you know, two different people can say preventable or not. And I think from a safety standpoint, at least going in, the assumption should be they're always preventable. The question is how much effort do you want to spend preventing it?
Right.
You may not choose to prevent it, which is can be totally rational decision, but when people take the opinion that things aren't preventable, they stop thinking, and depending on where you are with your knowledge at the time or resources available, the same event may appear preventable or unpreventable, and if it's deemed unpreventable, people stop thinking about it or it doesn't get attention, and that sometimes can have long-term adverse effects for the system as a whole.
Right. No, that's good.
This is Sam. The other thing, that second point, indicative of a problem in the facility's safety systems, again, back to the behaviors piece, somehow weaving that into this as well.
Yep.
And this is Nancy. Maybe in that sentence it could not just the safety systems but the safety standards.
Mm-hmm. Okay, all good comments. Thanks again. Now, we have defined previously each of those terms: event, adverse, preventable, serious, unambiguous. And those are on our last slide, Eric. And the group left a couple of them the same and changed a couple of them. Jim, to your point about preventable, describes an event that could have been anticipated and prepared for, but that occurs because of an error or other system failure. The steering committee last week felt that that was still a reasonable definition of that term.
Well, I wouldn't disagree with that, but I would argue that virtually anything's preventable.
Right.
You know, because it could have been anticipated by who? You know, I mean, if you go back, there was the trying to remember who wrote it, but wrote the article soon after the IOM to Tahrir's Human Report came out, Rod Hayward.
Yeah.
And they re-looked at a lot of the data from the Tahrir's Human data, and they gave it to three internists. And if two of the three agreed it was preventable, they said it was preventable. If only one did, they said it wasn't, which was, you know, it was a definition one could use, but it's logically ridiculous. It's like saying you lost your car keys, and if two or three people in the room didn't see the keys, then you wouldn't go look where they told you.
Right.
I mean, it's kind of, you know, pedantic and not,
mm-hmm.
wow. So, I mean, I don't mind this, but I wonder, is one thing you want to work against is quit talking about preventable, the assumption being if there's a problem, you should look at it to see how would you go about preventing it, and if it's feasible, you do so, and if it's not, you're not. And that goes to what the cost, the resource expense, and I don't just mean fiscally, it can be opportunity cost, et cetera. And that, I think that's how you want to get people to do is evaluate risk and then mitigate risks that are prudent. And the preventability, I think, can obfuscate some of that, or at least I'm concerned about that.
Right.
Yeah, this is Bob Weirs. I would second that. I think preventability has the slippery slope problem that we just described. I think it does tend to get people off track into a sort of a numbers counting thing and gives it sort of an easy defense. I would rather have us, look at events that have the potential to highlight something that we should, take action about. And I think I'd almost just get rid of it altogether in the definition.
Okay.
This is Helen. I agree with that. I think preventable, the whole concept keeps people from asking questions that need to be asked. They sort of try to put things into a category without looking too hard.
I agree with that, and I was thinking about suggesting eliminating it too. In a way, they're all preventable.
Right. Okay, good comments. Thank you.
What you want to prevent is harm, and error is more provider-oriented than patient-oriented.
Right.
Well, you know, in our system, we don't use the word error and we don't use the word preventable. We talk about preventing harm to the patient, period. Because that's what the patient cares about. They don't want to hear our excuses about why we didn't prevent it. They just want to say, how are you going to prevent it?
Right. Sorry, Denise, go ahead.
Right. I just totally agree with the whole idea of using the terminology preventing harm. And I think I want to just mention the other side of the argument around preventable. I live in Pennsylvania, so the state is very highly legislated in terms of HAIs and other patient safety reporting. But some of the issues around, going to the point of saying that everything is preventable does get a little tough when you're looking at ICU infections, fungal infections in patients who have every kind of line, and you're actually all of the evidence-based practices and the bundles are in place, and I think that's really our job is to make sure that, every measure that can prevent harm is in place. But despite all of our best efforts, and, this gets to the whole idea of targeting zero versus getting to the irreducible minimum, and, my feeling is, and I'm an advocate always for zero as being our goal for healthcare-associated infections, but I know that there are some from studying every single one of them that are not absolutely preventable. So when we use the language that every adverse event is preventable, we can get in some degree of trouble when states start, becoming, very punitive in their legislation around, things like HAIs and, so I just think that the whole concept of preventing harm, and again, I'm not saying that we should, that most things aren't preventable, and in fact that most infections aren't, but I think, the whole issue and controversy around, what isn't preventable is something that we should not spend a lot of time and resources on and just agree that, there is language that really expresses the mission of this group as well as any other patient safety advocacy group in the country. But I really very much like the preventing harm versus what is and what isn't preventable.
Right. Good comments, Denise. Thank you so much.
Peter, Chuck here.
Yep.
In the safe practices, we had really guided and migrated away from focusing just on error and really emphasizing harm the way that this is. The other issue is that whether you have preventable or not, the waterline will continue to move up as we get better and better at identifying areas to improve higher performance care. So that relative term does pose some difficulty, but But focus on harm is where the safe practices have gone, and we've been pretty careful to avoid using the term preventable and start the debate there, but try to keep things clearly on harm, and that the evidence supports how you can improve care, and the consequence of improved care is less medical-related harm.
Good. Chuck, thank you for that crossover between the two programs. So some of the other terms that were not changed was the term event, means a discrete, auditable, and clearly defined occurrence. And the term unambiguous was not changed by the group. It refers to an event that's clearly defined and easily identified. But as you can see on the slide, the term adverse and the term serious were both changed a little bit. And getting along with the comments just a moment ago about preventability, within the adverse definition, we did get rid of that whole concept of preventable, and that was adverse describes a negative consequence of care that results in unintended injury or illness. And we got rid of the whole which may or may not have been preventable. So I think that supports a lot of what you guys were just talking about. The term serious generated quite a bit of discussion, and we basically got rid of a large chunk of this definition, as you can see on the slide. We now have it reading, serious describes an event that can result in death or loss of a body part, disability, or loss of bodily function, or the risk thereof. And the or risk thereof carried a lot of weight for some of the folks on the steering committee, because it implies that you don't necessarily have to have an actual disability or death show up. It gets you towards the near misses and those types of events. The fact that the system process is there that allows this to potentially occur. So that was an important distinction. And then we got rid of all that other language that had a time frame on it of 7 days or present at the time of discharge, got rid of the type of facility, and the fact that it's not trivial. It was all felt to be quite redundant language. Any further comment on those two terms, adverse and serious?
Under serious, does it include psychological?
Yeah, we talked a lot about that, and the presumption was that the psychological is any part of the disability.
And does system failure encompass absent systems?
Yes. Although those are both of those questions are two presumptions that, you know, presumes a certain degree of knowledge of what we're talking about, as opposed to being very clear and explicit in detailing those two things.
Thanks.
Other comments?
I guess my question is the word unambiguous. Have we not gotten to that, or have we passed it?
Well, I kind of went through it because the group did not change it at all. But
well,
if you have comment on it, by all means.
Well, I guess my question is how unambiguous is the word unambiguous? It seems to me that it's something like preventable, that it's in the eye of the beholder.
Yep.
And I wonder about using it as a criterion.
Okay.
This is Rita. I don't know if I know Michael's familiar with the National Coordinating Council NCC Medication Error Reporting Program. So they have definitions for medication errors as an entire taxonomy. And I know when I look at the, at the list of SREs, there are some things that can cause temporary harm. I was going back to the website for the NCC MERP to see if there was anything there that would be of value to integrate here. Because sometimes it can be serious, but it's not in terms of the actual. It's not death or loss of a body part, disability or loss of bodily function. It's more, or risk thereof, I guess, would qualify. But I'm just wondering if there's some existing language that could be used from that organization.
Well, we'll certainly have a closer look at that.
Yeah, I'd be happy to send it to whomever you'd like me to email it to. I can send it back to Eric if you'd like.
Yeah, sure, please. Go ahead.
And then he can take a look and see if there's anything applicable.
Yep, Eric's our definitions guy. He
okay,
loves that job.
I'll send you that information then.
Peter, Dan Ford, following up on Helen, what does the term unambiguous add to this? And why do we need to define it?
Yeah, the three terms of unambiguous, preventable, and serious, at least during last week's group discussion, you know, these are terms that have been around since the origins of the serious reportable events.
Right.
There was a general sense that these, in at some degree, are part of the recognition that these are bad things, and these are the terms that have just sort of become associated with them. It was interesting, we didn't actually go to the same level of discussion as this group quickly went to, and that is, should we just get rid of half or all of these terms?
Well, is it still useful today?
It's certainly a question that can be challenged and asked. Yep.
Yeah, I was going to ask about the unambiguous, too. I mean, why is that? You know, I don't know if it adds a lot. I would probably can it myself.
Okay.
Yeah, I think, again,
this is
like...
Denise, I agree with that, too.
Yes. All right. So we've gotten rid of two of the three words. That's good. Well, we'll certainly bring this back to the committee and let them know of your guys' inputs. This has been very good discussion. I appreciate all of it. In the interest of time, I'm going to move us along unless somebody has a pressing point that they'd like to make further on this set of definitions around SREs. Okay. I wanted to try and spend the last few minutes getting the focus, and this will be an ongoing discussion for this group, but we won't go through detailed updates every time we meet going forward. However, we do want you to begin addressing these questions for us, and that is, we've got four questions, a couple of them have sub-bullets, and Eric, if you could get those up on the screen, that'd be good. There they are. And for a couple of you who are on the phone, on the cell phones traveling, we basically proposed four questions. One, recognizing that NQF is currently pretty much committed to its existing safety programs, SREs, safe practices, the measures, and the NPP project. The question is, what of these programs have the best perceived benefit for U.S. healthcare? And which of them provide the least perceived benefit? Let me just finish reading the questions, and we'll go back to them one by one. I don't think we'll get through all of them in the next 15 minutes, but what other new types of NQF patient safety programs should be considered for us in addition to what we have going and the platform that we exist on? And is there value in attempting to develop cross-linkages between these different programs, again, serious reportable events, practices, measures, NPP, and others? And if so, where should we begin to do that the quickest? And then harmonization of inter-organizational initiatives is often expressed as an expressed concern by healthcare. And which other organizations should NQF be harmonizing with for patient safety? And which of the programs should we begin to prioritize and harmonize with? So those are the four questions with their subcomponents. Maybe I'll open it up about the harmonization question, and if Chuck is still on the line, maybe Chuck, you could describe a little bit about what's gone on with the safe practices and the efforts that are there, and then we can come back to looking at how some of these other programs may or may not fit this type of strategy.
You bet, Peter. What we did in 2003, the safe practices were pulled together by steering committees with this kind of a consensus process. And I chaired the LeapFrog group initiative to tie a measurement of transparency to that set in 04, so that, and then was appointed to the co-chair of the N2F Safe Practices in 04-05. And we applied the experience of this transparency sort of approach to recognizing that that harmonization was critical. So when we convened our group to put together the 06 update in 05, what we did was we harmonized them down to the spec level with IHI, the other NQF measures, CMS, Joint Commission, LeapFrog Group, and IHI that had been actually the developer of a number of the best practices and had ongoing collaboratives in the process. So that harmonization effort went right down to the spec level of the endorsed practices section, which are the endorsed, the endorsed practices, the implementation guides and the problem statements and other elements don't have that same designation. But right down to the spec level, we got all those groups to agree, and it actually bent the curve of a lot of work that all of them were doing, realizing that there was now a standardized set. So then when we went when we developed the update for the 09 update, we'd already had that momentum had been built. So we broadened the harmonization collaborative initiative across, for instance, with HAIs, the compendium group that had developed the HAI practices that were released in October October of 08. And that gave us an additional group of harmonized organizations such as CDC, IDSA. We worked very closely with APIC in the implementation sections. And so once the momentum was obtained in terms of harmonization, many of the practices are harmonized now over as many as 10 organizations. And so it's a hard process to get going at first, and it's kind of herding cats, and it's focused, but the focus on getting right down to the spec level has really paid off. So I think, Peter, what you're asking us is, you know, should and how and who should there be a harmonization activities with the other programs and then tying them together? Is that our charge?
Yeah, we're looking for inputs on, which of the programs are, I think, amenable to those kinds of harmonization strategies, as well as how do we, your guys' thoughts on how do we internally even try to weave some of the NQF programs and harmonize them amongst themselves as well. But your description of what went on with the safe practices, I think, was a good example of a strong outreach across the field, and it seems to have worked. But comments or reactions to what Chuck just described?
That makes sense. I guess when some of the clinical arenas, the National Clearinghouse on Clinical Guidelines oftentimes have updates. So for example, anytime anyone looks at VTE, we look at chest. And so I would assume that that's already occurring, that the recent clinical evidence is always integrated in the development of these different initiatives.
Yeah, as we look at the safe practices, re-review them as we maintain the serious reportable events, we re-review the evidence base on those. The measures that are submitted by different measures developers, part of their process is that they need to provide the supporting evidence as well. And we rely a bit more on those external groups to do that work.
Right, right.
But it's important that we make sure we've got the most up-to-date evidence in all of these.
My difficulty in responding is wondering what type of other organizations we're speaking about, because there's so many organizations that are involved in one way or the other patient safety. They're accrediting, they're regulatory organizations, they're professional organizations. So it could be a long list. Could you explain more what type of organizations you had in mind?
Well, it's actually kind of an open-ended question, John, and that's part of why we're asking your guys' inputs on that. You know, what we could take it at the level of what types versus what specific organizations. We've typically made sure that we relate closely with ARC, with Leapfrog, with the Joint Commission. We certainly keep an eye on what's going on with organizations like Mike's, ISMP, IHI, et cetera. The National Priorities Partnership now has 32 member organizations in that collaboration, and they come across a variety of spectrums of types of organizations, some of them consumer-oriented, some of them vendor-oriented, et cetera. And within our own membership of NQF, we have a wide variety of types of organizations. But let me throw it back to the group in terms of trying to create synergy with the types of initiatives that impact healthcare organizations of different types. What are the types of organizations that, we should be focusing on, in your guys' opinion?
One more comment, too. Back in the early old days, it seemed like AHRQ was sort of charged with that idea of sort of gathering the troops and getting collaboration amongst different organizations and groups, but perhaps that's not true anymore.
Well, they do some of that. I'm not sure we see it to the same extent that we would like it to be there, but certainly an open comment.
I think one that comes to mind is HHS has just developed a new Office of Healthcare Quality. I think Don Wright is the appointed director. And clearly, there's an opportunity for significant integration. As if I'm to understand the concept, that helps bring in line the efforts of ARC, CDC, and CMS, and a more singular focus around quality.
But, we've had some discussion with Don Wright, mostly around the HAI action plan, and recently learned that he was headed into that new appointment. I don't know if he's got a good, strong concept of exactly where they're headed overall, though, but it will be important to keep in touch with Don. Thanks for bringing that up.
Peter, this is Denise. At the HICSAC meeting last week, again, we were having a very similar discussion around partnerships in the development of the national guidelines for prevention of HAIs, and then because HICPAC's role is really the vetting of the research and the scoring of the evidence and then coming up with recommendations and categorizing them, who do we partner with in order to execute and really implement? And the experience of the HAI compendium came up as an example, and there was a lot of inclusion-exclusion kind of angst around who's in and who's out and who's in at what point, that sort of thing.
Right.
But everyone did agree that for the issue of addressing HAIs, that the front line really needed to be represented in terms of the SHE and APIC and the IDSA, in terms of the people who are responsible at the front line for turning those guidelines into practice, or at least translating them for the front line healthcare team. So I don't know if that's helpful or not, but we had the identical conversation list last week with HICPAC. And then another important point that was raised was the partnership with NQF, and that HICPAC cannot go forward, especially with the real goal being for a lot of the governmental agencies to be working very closely together, that we really needed to be in lockstep with NQF as well around any of the work around HAI. So I thought that was worth mentioning since we were looking at, going forward as NQF, who do we look at as our closest partners.
Right. Good comments, and I'm glad to hear that you guys were talking about us. That's good news.
Peter, this is Mike.
Yep.
I think an important area, too, regarding HHS is that the National Coordinator, I think it is, for Health Information Technology.
Yep.
That particular office. I mentioned this at the face-to-face meeting that we had, the ongoing problems that we get reported to us regarding computer and automation system safety from the vendors, that is.
Right.
The vendor the problems that we have with the vendor software, for example.
Right. Well, and the NQF is tightly involved with that. Both Janet Corrigan herself as well as Floyd Eisenberg, our HIT guy. And as many of you know, NQF recently had the quality data set released, which was part of our HIT expert panel's output. And so we'll continue to try to not only stay in touch, but actually to influence what that set of activities and discussions are going on with.
You know, this is Rita. To piggyback on what Mike said, I'm thinking more about not just the technology itself. Maybe this goes up to question number two that we started out with four. But one of the things that I've heard from colleagues around the country and that I've certainly experienced even in our work here as we're putting in an EMR is the and this I'm sure the VA has lots of experience with is the understanding of the end-to-end workflows upon implementation of these systems and the safety issues. And there's been plenty that the Joint Commission has talked about, and VA has done outstanding work sharing their experiences. But it's almost it almost needs to be a requirement that end-to-end workflows be clearly understood before these systems are implemented.
Hey, let me jump in and add something to that. I know we're moving ahead to the next question, but I was going to save this for question two. This is Bob Weirs from Florida. I'm sorry. It goes much beyond workflow.
I know. Simple.
Yeah, workflow is one place, but essentially these are becoming safety-critical process management systems,
and
they are not being designed and implemented at the vendor end in safety-critical ways, nor are they being evaluated independently for safety prior to distribution.
Yep.
And in no other hazardous industry would we deploy IT this way.
Okay.
So I think at a very fundamental level, we need to articulate the need to step back and look at these systems very seriously. And there are methods and models that aren't perfect but exist in other industries that could be brought to bear here.
Good point, Bob. Thank you. Well, I am mindful of the time, and while we are just getting started on the discussion, I think we will respect your time. These questions will bring to the forefront early. I think what we'll do is redistribute these as a Survey Monkey over the next couple of weeks, get some inputs from you by utilizing Survey Monkey and perhaps asking for other areas that you may want us to consider. And then we can use this as the first upfront focal point of our deliberations during the next call. I don't want to slip into the habit of reporting out for half of the meeting and then looking for ways to get you engaged. I'd rather have you engaged early on and try to figure out some of the other venues, like just email updates for the reporting outside of this thing. We value your input. We certainly respect your time. And so it's much more useful for you and much more useful for us to have you deliberating as opposed to just listening. So this is all part of our learning to work with a new type of committee that's more advisory as opposed to highly focused on specific projects and measures, et cetera. So I appreciate your tolerance as we keep moving along in this. Anything as we close out that you would prefer us to be doing as we move along in getting this group up to speed, up to momentum? You're all seasoned committee folks, and I do recognize we're doing something different for many of you, but other things that you'd rather be doing with this group that we haven't touched on so far? Well, if you think of some, by all means, don't hesitate to send me or Eric an email. We'll follow up with some brief meeting summary notes from this meeting. We'll follow up with the Survey Monkey, and we'll continue with our flow of information as we provide updates on the different groups. And so with that, I'll suggest that we close off for the day unless someone has some other closing comments or questions. Hearing none again, thank you so much for your last 90 minutes.
Thanks,
and we'll provide the follow-up, and we'll keep getting us focused as we just suggested. So thanks so much, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Right. Thanks,
thank you.